Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show, Monday through Friday,
on the Athletic Podcast Network.
And welcome back to another edition of Hoops Adjacent on the Athletic NBA Show. David here in D.C. We got Waz in L.A. What's up, sir?
I'm here, man, chilling. Cannot complain. You know, the NBA Finals are finally interesting.
Yes.
And, you know, ready to go here.
Yeah, we are taping this on Tuesday, the day of game four. So the Lakers have a 2-1 lead. We saw Jimmy Buckets have a game for the ages. And to talk about that, talk about all things in the association, our friend Michael Lee. Michael, what's up, man?
Hey, what's going on? Enjoying this nice fall weather. I'm glad it's jacket hoodie weather now, so I'm feeling in my zone.
Yes, exactly. I feel very good about my sweatshirt ensemble for this year, so I'm good to go. I like the little chill in the fall air. Hey, before we start with the finals, two things. Number one, I'm getting all these bots jumping on my Twitter. Why is that? Why do we think that is? I'm getting all these Scott 578321s. And you know what I'm getting, guys? I'm getting a lot of fake black people bots. Have you been getting these on Twitter? Like all the, you can tell because they're so lame with how they try to show the Ghana born. You know what I mean? Like,
really?
Okay. And you have two followers. You know what I mean? Like, so are you guys getting that? Are you getting all these political bots all of a sudden?
I have not, but maybe my Twitter's not militant enough. Yeah. I need to step up my militancy to get some bot love.
What would you have to say to like really piss off people to get the bots on you?
I don't even know. Probably talk about reparations or something. I don't even know what gets them going.
Man.
Just be a black man.
Yeah,
on Twitter.
It's just been crazy. Like it's so obvious in the last 3 weeks. Like all of a sudden, all these people are following me that have never followed me before, but yet my overall numbers on Twitter don't go up any. You know what I'm saying? So clearly this is like a bot invasion of not real people.
Let's bring DA into the conversation here.
Welcome to Hoop.
Comma is
adjacent on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Turned it on and I heard Shaq with the barbs. It's like the most in his bracket. No, I was transported right back into it. I was like, oh, this is great.
I think I rap better than Shaq.
David Aldridge.
Oh, he's totally playing. Yes. Yes. And then he got their lungs out in front of everybody on TV.
Michael was not your friend.
It was popping in
there. Wozni Lembre.
So the Chicago and Detroit stuff, that was real.
That was real.
I mean, God forbid we don't have scholarship monies and can't pay for the charters for the water polo in Iowa.
Hoops adjacent.
Welcome to Hoops.
5, 4, we have ignition.
Stay mellow.
The comma is.
Also, on the NBA's tip, what do we think? Mike, you were in Philly a lot. What do you think about Doc going to the Sixers?
Yeah, I'm not as excited as it would be if you just put it on paper that Doc Rivers is going to Philadelphia. One, because, you know, I was hoping that after things sort of collapsed in Clipperland that Doc would take some time off and that he would really try to evaluate the field and figure out what the next best job is for his next move. Philly just is just a real tough situation to step into.
It sure is.
On paper, it looks like a great job because, you know, you got a 50-win team. You got two foundational stars and Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons. And it's like, okay, that's a great starting point. Any organization will want that. But once you start peeling that onion a bit and start looking at what's going on, it's not sweet. You know, it's not a situation where you're going to step in and just have a team that's ready to compete and contend. You got a lot of confusion. You got a lot of guys who don't understand their roles, who aren't willing to accept their roles, and there is no established hierarchy. And Doc's going to have to come in and basically establish that right away. And that's not going to be easy because the last however many years, you know, guys have been able to build up bad habits and sort of make assumptions about what they're entitled to, and they've never been held accountable. And so, you know, there's a reason why they went out in the first round this year. And it's not just because Ben Simmons was hurt. They had chemistry issues. It's stepping from one mess into another. And so I would be excited about it and say this is a great fit and he's going to go in there and turn it around. But I just feel like there's a lot that he's going to have to clean up And considering that he left a pretty big mess behind, it's going to be a lot of work to just go in and just say we're going to be a successful championship team right away.
Mike, you just laid out a lot there, and I want to get into that. The first thing I want to ask you, because I could tell this is something that you were intimating, who is in charge over there, right? There was a sense, and we got reports, you know, a few months back, a few weeks back, that maybe Elton Brand wasn't actually empowered and emboldened to make the moves that he wanted to do. Maybe the ownership situation is a little bit more chaotic than, you know, has been presented, because, you know, we know the chaotic ownerships, right? The Knicks, the Sacramento Kings, Tillman Fertitta, you know, but you don't really hear about Philly as being part of that dysfunctional group. What's going on with management over there?
Yeah, I mean, you ask somebody one day or one week, you get a different answer. And I think that's a major problem. You know,
yeah, that's not good.
That's not good. And I think that's been their main issue. Structurally, they haven't really established it. It all goes back to, you know, when they removed Sam Hinkie and brought in Colangelo, and then he had the whole burner account situation. And from that point on, it was just everybody kind of
burner account situation. I love
it. It became a power play. Then everybody was positioning themselves to become the next man in charge, and everyone promoted themselves as being the one running the show. And there wasn't a lot of cohesion in terms of, you know, the direction that they wanted to go. And so Elton has been the face, but everybody else behind the scenes has sort of been sort of making it seem like, well, I'm the one that makes the call. And when you have that kind of level of dysfunction, people, there's a lot of confusion. It just doesn't lead to a stable environment. And I think that, you know, this ownership, you know, they haven't really proven that they understand the game and just all the elements and layers of the game. They've been really eager to just stay chase names, chase stars, try to do anything to just raise the relevancy of the franchise. And they kind of got impatient because they took such drastic measures with the process, and they put the fans through a real miserable period. And like, they have to get a payback for that, right? You can't just have the fans just go through just punting seasons, 10 win seasons, 17 win seasons, and then say, we're doing this because we're building a championship team, and not give them one. And I think that's what they've been trying to do ever since Ben and Joel proved to be special talents. Then you just hit the fast forward button and expect to get there already. And it is really a process, right? I mean, for the most part, I mean, unless you just have LeBron and AD and you just go ahead and get right there in 1 year or something. But for the most part, it takes a lot, especially when you're dealing with young guys, who don't really know the league, but have been handed everything, have been told that they're the franchise, have been told that they're the guys that are going forward, and have not been challenged, have not been told to go out of their comfort zone and be something that they're not, or something that but could elevate the team. And I think when you look at that, the level of accountability just not being held. Joel Embiid, I think talent wise, is one of the probably five most special guys in the league, just from a physical standpoint, just his skill set. But he doesn't have anybody really pushing him to be greater. And that's something that Doc's going to have to do. Ben Simmons, really gifted, a tremendously gifted player. Guys can guard. He can guard all five positions out there on the floor. And when he's playing at a high level and when that energy level is there, there aren't many players in the league that can match him, because he's just so, you know, such a physical force. But he doesn't always bring it, and he doesn't always seem to have the mindset of like, this is, I'm going to make winning plays, as opposed to, I'm going to make sure my box score looks nice at the end of the day. And so when you have those elements, you have these things in place, you have a lot of fixing to do. And you just hope that they haven't developed so many bad habits along the course of the way that that they can't be fixed.
I would say the one thing that I do like about the hire, and I agree with you, I think it's first of all, I don't know why Doc felt the need to jump right back in.
He took like 2 days off.
Yeah, he could have literally done anything. And I said this, he could actually have run for the Senate, you know, from wherever state he's from, if he want, you know, like, he literally has that kind of profile right now. If you don't sit down and think about, you know, all the options that you actually have, whether it's TV or politics or just taking a year off, you know, and just kind of clearing your head, I think he should have done that. But then again, I thought Andy Reid should have done that when he went right from Philly to Kansas City. We know how that turned out, right? So
it seemed to work out pretty well.
Yeah, I could be wrong on that, you know. So,
but at the same time, DA, you know what that is. It's the same reason Pat Riley goes out and gives Hassan Whiteside $120 million. Like, I'll show you, LeBron. Right. Watch. Yeah. Oh, you think you want to leave me? Watch what we do without you. It's that type of thing.
Tyler Johnson.
Right, watch what
Tyler
I do.
Tyler Johnson, $75
million. Right. Yeah. It's the same. It's sort of the two sides of the same coin. It's like, watch what I do in Philly with all this talent and all of this. It wasn't me that messed this up. It was right. Paul George. And, right. You know, I think it's
yeah.
the sort
yeah,
it's of,
these guys gasping for air in game seven. They had no.
Yeah,
no
right, it's this sort of, I got to prove these guys wrong about laying the blame at my feet, you know? And I think that's what's driving this. And you could call it ego. You could call it competitive nature. You can call it whatever you want, but it seems like he has something to prove.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And also, you know, and Doc is good with stars, with big, you know, big performing ego type people. So, he did well with Garnett in Boston, I think. He did better with Pierce. So I think he's, you know, the results in L.A. were mixed, obviously, but they certainly were a contending team just about, I think, if I remember, every year he was there.
My concern, though, is in just considering, like, you talk about what he did in Boston and what he wasn't able to do in L.A., there's such drastically different situations. Because when he had the Boston gig and he had KG and Ray and Paul, those guys were in their 30s. They had to do whatever it took to win a championship, or their careers were going to be just nothing. Like they didn't have any time. Like they had to get it done. And you saw that they got it done quickly that first year. They got it, and that was it. That was the run. You know what I mean? They went back to the finals and everything. They didn't win another championship. And so when you got guys who are open to coaching and really want it at that moment, and there's nothing that's going to hold them back. You're in a perfect situation as a coach. When you go with young guys who are still trying to establish themselves and still trying to make a name for themselves, that's when it gets a little tough. And I think
it does. I agree with you. But I just think, you know, I think Embiid and Simmons are at the point, like, they're not rookies anymore. Now, they're not, you know, 10-year vets, like you said. But I do think they're at the point now where they've gotten a little flack now. People are looking at this team and going, well, look, you could fire Brett Brown, but Brett Brown is not the reason why this team's underachieving. You know what I mean? Like, so, you know, I think they're getting a little ack right now, and people are looking at them kind of sideways, like, well, what are y'all, you know, what's up with you two? Like, why can't y'all make this team better? You got two all-stars, a first team all defensive player, a second team all NBA player. And y'all go out in the first round, you know, that's not just coaching. You know what I mean? So I think they might be, I could be wrong. I think that they might be a little bit more receptive to somebody that's got the gravitas that Doc has coming into gig. But I could be wrong.
Well, I think a couple things they're going to have to do, though, is they're going to have to find a way to revamp the team in some ways in terms of their chemistry. There's just a lot of residual resentment. I think that a lot of the players didn't necessarily like the fact that, you know, Joel's the go-to guy, and Brett made it very clear that he's the foundation, but he didn't always bring it in practice, and he wasn't always going to practice, and he didn't always, you know, set the tone in that environment when nobody's watching, you know? And I think that for some teammates, that frustrated them because they felt like, well, if he's not showing up in practice every day, why is he entitled to the ball? Like, I'm still good here. Like, let me do my thing. And then, you know, so it's got to start from him. He's got to be willing to be committed to that end. And he's got to have a coach that's going to push it and demand that of him. And that's really going to be Doc's challenge, you know, to try to make sure he gets the most out of these guys. I think the one encouraging thing is that he has some history with Tobias Harris. Tobias basically got his $180 million contract because of what he did with the Clippers, not anything he did with the Sixers.
So
Doc's going to have to be able to, you know, come up with pick and roll situations so that he's not just floating out there, sometimes lost, not knowing when he should go and when he should defer. And they got to do something about Al Horford. He clearly was not a fit, and he clearly doesn't like he has a place there. So I don't know where they can move him, but they got to figure out, like, can we get Chris Paul? Can we get somebody in here who can sort of answer some of our problems and provide that leadership, you know, sort of light a fire under everybody. So it's not just on the coaches to do it. because I think it's going to be important for guys like Ben and Joel to hear it from a player, and to hear it from a player who has nothing to lose and can come in and really kind of help Doc, you know, push the system along. But there's a lot of elements in Philly that I'm like, I was hoping that they would get, you know, a coach in there who, you know, maybe come in with a fresh rep and could come in and just sort of just be demanding and sort of just say, okay, this is how it's going to be. Now, Doc might have to come in there and do that, but I just feel like the way the things ended in Clipperland this year, I mean, even with all the stuff with COVID, I mean, he was a tough situation. I mean, yeah. A lot of his players did not want to be in the bubble. Like, they just did not want to be there. And they were looking forward to having an opportunity to just get out of there.
And it showed in game seven.
It showed in game seven, but it showed throughout the whole run. I mean, you had the three guys, holders from last year. I mean, they all had personal, you know, tragedies and things that they had to deal with. And they left the bubble and came back. That disrupted chemistry. But those guys just didn't necessarily want to be competing and playing basketball at this time of the year. And so when you put that in the mix, it was going to be a mess, but there was a lot deeper stuff going on there too that he wasn't able to fix.
Yeah, I think with Kawhi and the Clippers situation, there definitely was a certain level of deference obviously showed to the guy. Like, being around the team on a, you know, sort of semi day-to-day basis, you could tell that Kawhi was getting preferential special treatment from the team, because one, it's like, we're the Clippers. Nobody of this caliber has ever chosen us this explicitly, right? When you talk about Kawhi's credentials as a champion, finals MVP, MVP candidate, you know, he's clearly demonstrated that he is an elite player and he's, you know, he's at the top of his position. I don't know that anybody on the Sixers deserves that level of deference. Nobody on the Sixers I can remember ever carried somebody to the finals or won finals MVPs and, you know, got it done at the highest levels of the sport. I don't see anybody on that team. So I have, you know, less of a concern when it comes to that. My concern is I don't like the roster construction. Mm-mm, I don't like the fit of the roster. Your two best guys, to my mind, cannot be optimized in the same lineups. Maybe I'll be proven wrong, right? Maybe they'll do stuff like normal teams do by surrounding their young guys with shooters. And maybe that'll actually work. But I don't know. Like, the way this roster's constructed, I don't think this team can optimize the talent that's there, Mike.
No, not the way it's constructed now. But I was intrigued by what Brett Brown was going to do in the bubble and playing Ben Simmons at the four. And I've sort of been in that camp from the beginning. Like, the only way this Simmons and B thing is going to work is if Simmons plays the four. And one of the main reasons why is because you cannot be handling the ball at the top of the key if you're never going to shoot. You are wasting the top of the key. You are not doing what you're supposed to do up there. I mean, yeah, you can survey the court. You can see what's going on and find shooters in the corners and drive and do what you need to do. But if you're not ever going to be willing to take a shot, then you are really limiting what the offense can do. And it's not even just what you do in terms of, you know, creating a defense, you know, how they have to respect your shot. You just open up the floor for everybody else, because now guys aren't just camped out in certain spots where you can just say, okay, well, I'm not even going to worry about him because I know Ben's not going to shoot it. Like, whatever. We can just load up on Joel. We can load up on Tobias. We can load up on all these other guys and just see what Ben's going to do. And he's not going to, but if Ben's at the four and he's in that dunker spot, you're not really standing. You're not standing in Joel's way. You're able to get offensive rebounds. You're able to survey the court, and you can kind of be like kind of a Bam out of Bayou, where you're working, you know, in that foul line area, and you can start feeding guys in that area. But if you're going to be facing the basket and try to operate from there and never attempt to shoot at it from beyond 2 feet, then you're not helping the team. And so that's what they're going to have to do. I think if they can play him at the four, and then play Tobias at the three, and then you just get two shooters, you can still play Ben in sort of a point power forward position where he's still making plays, but it's not just going to be the traditional way where he's just at the top of the key kind of running the show. You're going to need to have a point guard out there or somebody, a distributor at the top of the key who can move the ball but also be willing to shoot. Because right now, Ben's not helping them if he's never going to take a shot. And it's not about shooting threes. I don't really care about him shooting threes. We see Jimmy Butler get a 40-point triple-double without shooting threes.
You don't have to shoot threes.
But you have to shoot something.
You're 6'9". I mean, just give me a jump hook in the lane. That's fine. I mean, yeah, give me something you can score on 65-70% of the time.
And I will say this in Ben's defense, I know he always feels like he wants to make the right play all the time. Like, and sometimes he feels like the right play is him not shooting, you know, because he doesn't feel like it's going to be a high percentage shot. But if he can get that look for somebody else in the corner, or if he can get a look for Tobias, that's more of a better shot than him taking a jumper. And so he wants to make the right play all the time, but he's got to be able to take more risks. He's got to be a little more fearless and not be afraid to fail. Like, I want to see him go out there and just sort of just say, you know what? I don't care about how this looks. I don't care if I look cool right now. I don't care if people mock me and make fun of me because my jumper's not falling, but he's got to take it. And then the team will live with it. I guarantee you, if Ben got out there and just was fearlessly attacking and just like said, I don't care if my shot bricks, if I shoot a couple air balls, at least I know I'm doing the right thing for my team. They'll rally behind that and he'll get, and the confidence will come. But if you don't do it at all and you just stand at the top of the key and just move the ball around trying to just collect assists, now you're hurting everybody.
That's where I think where D'Antoni might have been a better fit for Ben, because he gives his players that kind of offensive freedom. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that he would have been a better coach. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
you know,
you're right.
You know what I mean? So that's where I could see them kind of going, I'm not sure that's the – because to your point, like, they both need – him and Embiid need somebody to challenge him, right, to really get
for
it.
For sure.
That's just not Mike's thing, and that's okay. Mike wins a lot of games playing the way Mike plays, and that's okay. You know, so it's fine, but just – he ain't gonna get put no foot in nobody's ass, is what I'm saying. That's just not his style.
They need somebody who's gonna be able to just, you know, get the shine on their boots and just start kicking.
Right.
But Mike, I would love to know what their options are as far as, you know, changing the roster, because the flexibility is kind of minimal, right? Like, once Markelle Fultz basically turned into a lemon in Philadelphia anyway, and they ended up just giving him away, their two young guys are on big deals. Obviously, we know Al's contract and Tobias's contract. So, you know, just cap-wise, they're capped out. And they don't seem to have many trade chips. So what can they do to get, you know, where are they going to find a playmaker at? A point guard? Like, they've never even had a point guard. And no disrespect to TJ McConnell, man. But, like, I'm talking about, like, a real point guard. You know, somebody that can initiate offense for you. What are their options here?
Yeah, it's tough. It's limited. I mean, like I said, I think Al's contract is probably the one that's most manageable, because it's not like guaranteed beyond this year. So they might be able to find somebody, like a team that's close, that feels like they can just say, okay, well, we'll go ahead and go for Al right now.
Well,
and
yeah,
he can push us over. But I'm saying he's the only guy I think they can potentially move, because Tobias, when he signed that big a deal, he's theirs, especially in this
Well,
new
climate. That's how you get CP3, right? I mean, you say, well, we'll take on CP3 at $47 million a year going on, you know, but you have to take Horford and or Tobias, you know, in some combination, right?
I think that's the only way they can make it work. But I think Horford's the one key that they have to find a way to move him, like, somehow, for his sake too. You know, because I always felt bad for Al last year, because, you know, he was with the Celtics and the whole situation with Kyrie, and it's just like a mess. And it's like, man, this team is like chemistry issues. I got to get out of here. I got to go somewhere where I can win. And then he goes to Philly and it's like, oh, snap, I'm back worse. In the same mess.
Yeah, it's worse. I know.
And it's worse. Yeah. We let him get out of the first round.
Fresh out the frying pan into the fire.
Yeah, exactly.
So he just needs a fresh, you know, place where there's just like, okay, maybe I won't win a championship, but I can just have fun playing basketball again, because this isn't it.
I'm not sure where the problem is. Where is that? Forget the money for a second. Like, Al is was he 34 now?
Somewhere 34? Around there, yeah, 33, 34, yeah.
You know, like, could he help teams? Sure. But now you have to bring the money back in. You just can't help him at $30 million. You know what I mean?
It's the contract that makes him tough. Because, like, you know, you look at a team like the Clippers, the Lakers. So many teams could use an Al Horford on their team. But at that number, it's hard for that to make sense. It's tough, man.
It is. But, you know, I think there'll be a lot of trades this offseason. I think there'll be a lot of movement. You know, teams want to get out of contracts. Teams want to go for it, you know. And the thing about the Western Conference now, when you see if the Lakers go ahead and pull this thing off, you're gonna need size. You're gonna need somebody who you can throw out and Anthony Davis or and you know, if they bring back Dwight and all those guys, Lakers are gonna be big, you know. And that's, and you're gonna need somebody you can put up against them. So maybe they can find a taker, you know.
Houston needs a size.
Oh my gosh,
sure.
Definitely they do, man.
Yeah. And you know what, I think teams will be aggressive because
he'd actually be a good fit in Houston, I think.
I think he'd be he likes shooting. He can set great screens for, you know, the two guys they got.
Right, pick and pop with Harden and with Westbrook. Yeah, that's a good fit.
And I think teams should be aggressive because I don't think any team should be watching this finals and thinking either one of those squads are juggernauts.
No.
Right? Like, you should feel like, hey, man, I'm right there. I'm right there. I can get to a finals with the right mix of guys and you know, tweaking the roster in the right ways. I don't know that any of those two teams that we're watching, and I like watching both teams, obviously, you know, and will engender any fear in the hearts of future opponents, you know?
Nobody should be afraid. I mean, look.
Not the way they're currently constructed, but you figure the Lakers are going to be able to find somebody else to – some more shooters and guys willing to play.
But I wouldn't be like, we can't beat the Lakers. No. I wouldn't think that if I'm the Clippers or Denver, or, you know, I wouldn't be afraid to play the Lakers, you know. I might need more talent, or might need to tweak how I play against them, but they certainly have enough to compete against them, I think.
I would think so too. But, you know, you just got to make sure you counter their size with something.
Yeah. Let's get Al Horford traded to Houston. I like this idea. That works. That makes too much sense not to do. But since you brought up the finals, let's get into that a little bit. And the whole notion of what's going on here. And I want to hear, you know, when both of y'all to jump in on the notion of, you know, I still think the Lakers are going to win this thing. But where do we put Jimmy Buckets' performance in the pantheon of great, great finals? I think it's one of the, you know, maybe top 10 of all time in terms of one game in the finals.
Yeah. When I saw it, I mean, that was my immediate reaction. Like, this is one of the best performances I've ever seen. And just considering the circumstances, the fact that they were missing two players, two of their best players, and they were up against a team that was up 2-0 and looked like they were going to sweep them. I mean, and he was just defiant. I mean, the beauty of this is that everything that, you know, that you said is like made Jimmy a terrible, you know, teammate in the past, right? All the stuff that you know, being defiant, being kind of confrontational, you know, all the things that, you know, that's exactly what you needed in game three. You needed somebody who just like, I'm a rage against the system, the establishment, you know, I'm pushing back against all that. And that's exactly what he did. Like, he just pushed back against all that. All the qualities that were once considered negative were the positives in that. So it was up there. I mean, I just sort of looked at just underdog situations, and I put it up there with Iverson's 48, you know, in game one against the Lakers, where, you know, it was a big statement game for him and for the Sixers. Came out of nowhere, they stepped over, still the most memorable image of that series, even though they lost the next four games. No one even cares about how the Lakers won in five. You just remember Iris' step over. You don't remember Shaq just destroying the Kimbe, really.
Well, I do.
I do too. He did turn him to a toothpick like 15 times, but still the memorable image is still Iverson. And then I was thinking about Dwayne Wade. In 2006.
In 2006.
Dallas won those first two games, went up 2-0. Everybody thought that was going to be a romp. Like, this is going to be a sweep. And then Wade scored, I think, 15 points in the fourth quarter of game three, had finished with 43. He was playing with five fouls. It was like the moment for Dwayne Wade. It was like the star turn. Like, Shaq immediately became the sidekick. It was Dwayne Wade's team. It was his show. And he was that first guy from the 03 draft to really emerge. It's like, this is going to be a special class, folks. This is it right here. Like, this dude is here. We got LeBron, Melo. But this is dude already first one to get that championship. And he did it on that stage and just proved he was a star. He scored 43 that night. And then, you know, averaged, I think, like 39 or something the rest of the series. Right. And like, so that was big. That was like an out of nowhere moment. And then you look at the 2015 series with LeBron going up against the Warriors without Love and without Kyrie. And just the fact that he was sort of a one man band and like efficiency be damned, I'm just going to try to get my numbers. And, you know, I'm playing with Dellavedova and Timofey Mozgov.
Right. Dellavedova.
And Tristan Thompson. I'm like, I'm going to win with these dudes. Like, y'all might have the Splash Brothers, but I'm winning with whatever I got. And they went up 2-1 and he had that 40 points, I think 12 rebounds, 8 assists or something crazy. And yeah, he just was, and he was determined. I think that was when people realized that, you know, one, Golden State wasn't necessarily, you could tell they weren't really ready to be champions until like it happened. And he was the only guy in there that was doing it. But just underdog performances, I'd put it right up there with any of them.
Yeah.
You know what it reminded me of? This performance came in a loss. But it reminded me of Russell Westbrook, game 4 in 2012 in the finals. They're down 2-1 and they're playing for their season, essentially. Yeah. People don't remember. Right. They remember game 5 and Mike Miller losing his shoe and all of the threes raining down on OKC's head. But the previous 4 games were extremely competitive.
Yes.
And in game 4, Westbrook just, they could not keep him out of the paint. Yeah. And we're talking about the most athletic team in the NBA at that time. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't do anything with Russ. And I'll just never forget that. He dropped 44. He put his heart into that performance. It came in a loss. But you could tell it was a guy playing for his season, as Jimmy was, right? Like, Heat go down 3-0, it's over. Yeah. It's over. The series is over. The season is over. And that performance was just amazing, man. And so I want to give a shout-out to Russ for 2012 because, you know, God knows he hasn't had much playoff success since.
Shouts to Russ. It's so funny. I remember that series, and Harden had been so good in the playoffs that year.
San Antonio, and he cooked.
He was just almost single-handedly brought him back, right, against San Antonio. Like, he was sensational.
He was.
And he was so bad in the finals, and I remember going, he'll never be this bad again in the playoffs.
But wasn't that the trap though? Wasn't he dating Trina at the time? It was like from Miami.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was taking one for the team there. She was helping the Heat win that championship there. Taking out Harden's legs the whole series.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't know. I would say this is a great finals. I don't think anything in the bubble can be viewed as great.
No, it's not great.
But it's been competitive, reasonably competitive. So with the Lakers, I think, again, we're taping this on Tuesday afternoon before game 3, game 4. We don't know what happened in game 4 yet. But assuming the Lakers go on and win this thing, what would that make LeBron? 4-7? Would that be correct?
4-6.
4-6 in the finals?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think you're starting to get to the point where the preponderance of the evidence outweighs the quality of it, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
There's just so many finals that you have to kind of put them in the conversation now, you know, even to an old head like me. But does the fourth one do anything for either of you in terms of reevaluating LeBron in terms of the all-time greatness?
Me personally, no. To me, it's LeBron, Kareem, and Mike in their own category. And then there's everybody else, right? And you could squabble because, like, some people might make an art, like, and people don't do it because of the nature of just Kareem's career and whatever. They don't ever make the argument for Kareem over Mike, but he's right there in accomplishments and championships. And, like, this, it's
he got
right
6'2",
there.
You know what I'm saying?
You know what I'm saying? Like, the guy is literally
James
right
Collins
there.
Basketball.
You know, it's crazy. Right. He doesn't have that profile, so he doesn't get it. But for me, LeBron is right there with Mike and Kareem.
Yeah.
Just the sustained excellence, the championships, the MVPs, the just elevating teammates, your team literally just by virtue of you being on it matters. Your team is competitive. And as far as the finals record is concerned, like, there's ways to denigrate the, you know, the 6 losses or whatever. But I mean, to me, the bubble just proves the point of it. It's like, you know, the Clippers were preordained to get there.
Right.
And they didn't. But like, that just should just show you something. Like, it's not easy to keep getting there over and over and over again. Now, I still, you know, even after winning this, I still think Mike had the highest highs in NBA history. And so therefore, to me, he's the greatest player. But I don't know. To me, like, those three guys are in a league of their own. And if anybody wanted to make the argument for LeBron, I would not personally look them like, oh, you're a psychopath. I'd be like, I can see the arguments. You know?
He's made 10 finals in 11 years.
<It's> crazy.
Come on, respect must be paid. You know what I mean? Like, that's just an insane number. It's just you have to.
And again, and DA in those, especially after 07, of course you can count 07. That was, you know, pretty much a fluke. The Cavs probably shouldn't have beaten Detroit. Whatever, you know.
Still the worst starting lineup in the history of the NBA.
Disgusting. That was ridiculous. He was terrible against Dallas. But you basically can't point to a playoff series after 2011 where this dude didn't deliver for his team. So, you know, it's all there.
Yeah.
It doesn't change anything for me. You know, it's almost like if you have, like, you got pasta sauce cooking. Yeah. You know, you already know what the sauce is, right? But you want to just add that one little extra seasoning in there. It might not taste any different. A four championship is just adding a little extra garlic in there.
Right.
It's you already know what you're getting. Like, you already know that the sauce is good. So you just add another ingredient that doesn't really change the flavor. You've already seen it. You've already seen how the whole sauce came together. And so this is what's happening with LeBron. Like, he could win 8 championships. For 10 championships, I don't think it'll necessarily change how I feel, because I know what I've seen. And I know that there's something to be said about efficiency, too, in terms of how quickly you do what you need to do. And so I don't really like the argument because I feel like it's unfair. And I feel like over the years, we've sort of really not been able to appreciate LeBron the way we should, because everything is brought up as a comparison to Mike, which I don't think is a fair comparison for anybody to have to live up to. And now he's brought a lot of that onto himself. You know, he said, I'm the greatest after I beat the Warriors and everything. And, you know, so he's asked for a lot of this, but I don't necessarily think I need to give it to him either because it's not, because I don't think it's fair. And I also don't think that it's allowed people to really, you know, acknowledge just how good he is and how great he is, because he's automatically brought up against, oh, well, what about Mike? And what about Mike? Well, just LeBron himself is already phenomenal. Within just his career speaks for itself just by itself. But when you always have to compare, they say, well, comparison is the what?
Sincerest form of flattery.
No. That's
imitation.
The opposite of joy or something, or like something like that.
Yeah, comparison is the opposite of joy. I love that.
Yeah, because what you're doing is like you're just ruining everything when you should just be appreciating it. And I just feel like we haven't really taken the time. We can have a LeBron conversation without talking about Michael Jordan. We don't have to bring his name up. We can talk about all of the great things, like you mentioned, 9 finals in 10 years. The fact that he's been a model of resilience, because he keeps coming back. You know, he stays relevant every year. You think you count him out, he comes right back. You know, either he builds a team that can get him right back in contention, or he winds up being right there in that conversation for MVP, you know, in year 17, which is like insane, something that you shouldn't be doing. So his career is pretty marvelous within itself. And we can just appreciate everything. The fact that he's going to be probably the retire as the all-time leading scorer, but scoring not be the best thing that he does on the court. You know, he's still a better passer than he is a scorer. There's never been a player this versatile, you know, who can do so much and impact the game in the ways that he can. So I think we can appreciate him and marvel at what he does without saying, well, Mike did this. Well, so what? Mike did that. That's right. We can put Mike's stuff on the shelf and just admire that for what it is. But right now, it's LeBron's time. So let's just admire LeBron for what he's doing right now and the fact that he's about to win another championship. And I think that could change the perception, because honestly, for me, it's taking a lot of the joy out of this run that LeBron's on, because every game is like a referendum on his legacy, and it shouldn't really be like that.
Right.
No, go ahead. But
and the bigger comp, to me, it's like, you know, LeBron is so much more like Magic than he is
for sure.
Michael.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's the comp. If you're going to make a comp, make an accurate one. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yes.
Like, that's the more, much more accurate comp to me is Magic.
And you know, Magic is like, my God, like, I love Magic. I mean, he won 5 championships and he went to 9 finals in his first 12 years in the
league. That's what I'm, that's the comp. That's what I'm saying.
4, right. And like, right. He did it from the jump. You know, he got there at 20 years old and he's jumping center and dropping, you know, 45.
Right.
You know, 42, 15, 7, you know, in the game 6 and, you know, with Kareem out. And so he's doing everything that you know, a legend is supposed to do from the beginning. And, but again, I think that the one thing that we'll always marvel about LeBron is the fact that, you know, he did have some extreme lows. You know, you mentioned Dallas, you mentioned the sweep against the Spurs, but he's had highs that are on the level with anybody who's ever played the game.
Yeah.
And in some instances, it's been higher. And so I think if we just sort of just, you know, try to just not stop trying to say, well, this guy did this guy did that, and just really just look at and examine LeBron for what he is and who he is, we really appreciate him a lot more. And it wouldn't just be this thing where people root against him because they don't want him to threaten Michael Jordan in some way, or people will root for him because they'll win some argument or feel like they'll win some argument or debate that he's on their level with Michael Jordan. It's just like, who cares? Why is Michael Jordan a part of this conversation? LeBron within himself is enough.
Yeah, and the finals talk is just hilarious to me. There's this notion out there that it's better to lose in the conference finals than it is to lose in the finals. Like, you know, like Kawhi and them won't have a finals loss on their record, so they somehow had a better season. Somebody explain that to Doc Rivers then. But, you know, I think what's interesting is that the only finals that LeBron's team ever lost as a favorite was Dallas, and if they lose this one, would have been this one, right? It's not like when people reel off all of the losses, and people say, oh, you got excuses, you're doing this. It's like, no, but this is basketball. This is reality. Like, yeah, a lot of times funny, when the team has the better team, they win.
I mean, you mentioned the OKC series, right? And like that Westbrook had a, you know, big game 4.
Right.
OKC had home court advantage in that series. But the Heat was the dominant team. You came away thinking, oh, the Heat.
They never got back home.
Yeah, you're like, OKC is not ready for this, right? But they were the team that was the favorite going in.
Yep.
Right, right.
So,
right.
I mean, every championship that he's won, except, I mean, even with the Spurs, I mean, they won that one as the favorite. But it was a shaky favorite, and they still needed a lot to go their way.
Those were evenly matched teams.
I remember that at the time, like, The comp wasn't Michael. The comp was KD. It was like, well, LeBron, who's better, LeBron or KD? LeBron or KD? LeBron or KD? You know, and it went on for years, right? I mean, that was what was argued about. And the fact that he has transcended Kevin Durant as a fair comp.
Just as a conversation.
That's what I'm saying. You don't even have that conversation anymore, right?
And Kevin, like, nobody seriously argues Kevin.
And yeah. Right. And Kevin's got 2 chips. And it's not, but nobody even has that conversation, right? He's not even, it's not even an argument anymore that anybody plausibly makes that KD's better than LeBron, right?
Hey, DA, I got a question for you, because you've been covering this league, you know, for a while. And when did people concern themselves with GOATs? Like, it feels a recent phenomenon. Like, I don't.
It is. Well, it's, you know, I think the first time I heard GOAT was in reference to Ali, of course, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and somebody had done that big coffee. Remember that big coffee table book that somebody made for like $400? You had to pay for it or something. But it was all about Ali, and it was, and I think it was called The GOAT, you know?
Okay.
And it was like, what does GOAT mean? Greatest of all time, right? So, yeah, I think that's where it started. But yeah,
as it relates to basketball, like I think that when Michael was playing, at least from me, my perspective, I just remember watching Michael, rooting against him because I didn't really want him to win all the time. But just acknowledging his greatness, but it never was like, man, is this the best player I've ever seen before? I never really tried to wrap my head around that, because I was just like watching him and admiring him for what he was.
Yeah,
and I feel like that we allow Magic to play basketball and just be great. And we just admired him and said, man, this Magic is awesome. I love, like, he's having so much fun out there on the floor. I've never seen anybody play with this much joy. Like, he made me love basketball. So, but I watched him, but I never said, man, this Magic might be the greatest ever. Like, I didn't care. And then when Michael came right after that, I was watching him and saying, man, this guy is really dominating. Like, no one can beat him. Like, this isn't fun. I don't like it anymore. No one can beat him. But I never said, man, is this the greatest I've ever seen before? I didn't really care to make a comparison. I just sat there and watched these guys play. Same with Kareem or anybody else. I never even got, it never became anything that was something that you discussed. I think, obviously, social media and talking head shows changes the conversation a bit, but it just feels like what we've done is, in some ways, we've allowed ourselves to diminish what LeBron's contributions to the games are because we've constantly put him up against a guy who most people have already decided is the best they've ever seen.
Right, but he did it. He's the one that told Lee Jenkins, I'm chasing a ghost, right?
Yeah.
He put it out there into the universe, right?
True.
Yeah, but I think with this chicken and this egg, I think that the chicken came first, right? Like, I think people were comparing him to Mike, and he had an understanding that that was the standard. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it was like, all right, I'm, you know, from day one. And you know, it's different for somebody like Kobe, who was literally like changed his like vocal cadence to talk like Mike.
So, right, he did the opposite.
Like, he was like, no, that's what I'm doing, right?
Right. And I'm impersonating Michael Jordan.
Yes. And I think that got put on LeBron. And he was like, well, I guess like it's not like that's going to change. Cause, you know, I remember the Chosen One Sports Illustrated joint. I remember the first sort of Sports Center, you know, when they got like Jeremy Shapp do like a little special little segment for up and coming thing. And Shaq is at the games and if he's a junior, but if he went to the draft right now, he'd be the number one pick. And I was like, I've never seen this before. I've been watching.
But that's the Mike's point about social media changing the equation. There's no question that that's true. And the other thing is that, you know, Magic, as great as Magic was and as great as Bird was back in the day, they were still the Lakers and the Celtics. You know what I mean? So there was never any thought that it was just Magic and Bird going against each other like they were playing horse or something. It was always they're the best players, but they're also on a team full of Hall of Famers. That's what made the Lakers and the Celtics so compelling, is that they each had multiple Hall of Fame level players playing in their primes at the same time against each other. And you just never, it's so rare that you have teams that good and franchises that historic playing against each other all the time, right?
So, yeah, you're right. And LeBron has made the franchise irrelevant, and it made it all about him.
Exactly.
Because he bounces around all the time. So,
and that's where the comp to Michael, I think, makes sense, because Michael, even though Michael was on one team most of his career, Michael transcended his teammates. As great as Scottie Pippen was, Hall of Fame player, as great as Rodman was, Hall of Fame player, he kind of transcended them. And it seemed like he was doing it by himself. And we know he wasn't, but that's how it felt to a lot of people. And so that's why I think people view them both kind of more as individual artists as opposed to, you know, laborers for a common good, like that, you know, Spurs hitting the rock thing, you know, and Mike ain't hitting no rock. You know what I'm saying? Mike is jumping above the rock. You know what I'm saying? So that's where I think that comparison started to come from. Even though, again, it doesn't make any sense because the player, he makes sense with his Magic. So
are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever. And that's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. LinkedIn Sales Navigator is a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals, and show you hidden allies so that you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you up-to-date first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/NBAshow23. That's linkedin.com/NBAshow23 for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/NBAshow23 and get started.
Can we very briefly get into, because I want to hear Mike's stance on this, because I think he has a decent, you know, his finger on the pulse with this stuff. The Kyrie situation. Where he says, I don't need a coach, and KD's the first teammate I've ever played with who can make a shot.
Right.
Brooklyn is going to be the best story in the NBA next year.
They're going to have a Nets index. ESPN is going to have a Nets index next year.
Like, Mike, what did you, like, when you saw the excerpts, and then to me, listening to it is actually worse. I read it and I was like, nah, you know, he probably was saying it a certain way, and there's no way he was implying what it's so obvious that he was implying. Then I listened to it and I was like, this dude is something else, right? I would love to know what Mike felt listening to that, man.
I'm going to encourage Kyrie to keep talking because he is providing so much entertainment content. You know, the one thing I do want him to do is, like, I want him to say it with his chest, though, because when he made the comment you know, he played with a guy who could, you know, he trusted that could make that shot in the end. Don't backtrack and say, I wasn't talking about LeBron. Well, you played with LeBron and won a ring with LeBron. So it's obvious. And he won and he made a lot of big shots with you watching. If you weren't talking about him, then name names of who you were talking about or specifically say, yes, I meant what I said, because I felt like when we were in the game, I was the guy. I was the guy that should have been closing. And you saw what happened in the 2016 finals. I took the last shot and I made it because I'm the man. Like, just say it. Like, say it with your chest. Like, if you're going to, be passive aggressive and, call somebody out, you know, without really directly calling them out. Don't backtrack when people make the connection about what you actually were saying. I understand that he was on there with KD and, like, maybe some things he said freely, you know, talking to KD that he might not wanted to get out, but he said it and it's out there. So embrace it. And be the villain if that's the case, you know, allow us to have these storylines because we know it's there, you know, and just embrace it. And so, Brooklyn's going to be an interesting team because he will need coaching and Steve Nash will have to coach them. He can't just roll the ball out there and just say, okay, you guys just curious. Like, he's going to have to come up with a system and a scheme that makes it work. The one thing that's intriguing about that pairing with KD and Kyrie is, like, it was for me, the minute it came together, it was very confusing for me. Because I know the friendship, I understand how close they are and just the connection they have that goes beyond basketball. But on the basketball court, the only time I saw them playing together was at the 2016 Olympics. And that was not an encouraging sign for what the future is.
No, it was not good.
When I was watching them play together, KD was not himself through the first couple of games in there. And the only time he really started to take off was when Kyle Lowry came in there and was running the offense as a point guard. Kyrie's out there doing his sort of, you know, magician stuff with the basketball and spin moves and between the leg dribbles and all these things that are great to watch. Like, it's like he's an artist out there. But if you're standing there and you're wide open or you got an advantage and your man's just over there just doing a dribble show.
He's an artist because he told us on his Instagram live. He's like, you know, appreciate the art. this guy is amazing.
He's best. He's the best. I want Kyrie to keep talking, man. Keep it coming, man.
It's really,
but,
yes.
But I'm intrigued.
Tell
to see
us
how
the moon's made
of
green cheese next. That'll be funny. No, seriously, it's made of green cheese. You know what I mean?
Like, actually, go to the moon because I know we can afford it. And then
right. I just don't know how you could go from I don't want to be my turn, your turn. I'm tired of it. I want to play with a team. I want to play with joy. I want to play with that. And yeah, I'm tired of that now. I'm going back to my turn, your turn. Okay. I mean, it's your dime, you know? So.
Yeah. And I just the idea that, like, you would say ain't no head coaches on this team. Matter of fact, the dude who Steve Nash came in and, you know, got hired over, he's a head coach sometimes. Yeah. Right. I'm a head coach.
Is a construct. It's just an idea. It's not actually a real thing.
It's like the Matrix up in this room.
It's burning. You know?
Yeah.
We don't need a coach.
Just finger snapping, y'all. Finger snapping like a poetry jam.
But like you said, it will be must watch. You be there. We will all be there from day one.
I'm pulling up a chair, front row.
Oh my God! Can you imagine?
Yeah, I mean, especially if they make a move. If they make a move this offseason to upgrade the roster and try to, you know, really go at everybody else in the East. Because, like you said, I mean, Miami's the defending Eastern Conference champion, but you know, Milwaukee, Boston. Yeah. I mean, they're right there. I mean,
and Milwaukee's going to have to do something just to keep Giannis. I mean, they're going to be different next year just because they have to be to keep Giannis happy. You know, so. Yeah, I mean, they're going to be right. Toronto, I don't think there's any, you know, backup in Toronto. I mean, and even if they lose, you know, Ibaka or they lose Gasol, look, they've shown they'll figure it out how to make their team work. You know,
you got to trust Masai. He's going to do something.
Right.
And I'm on record as saying, I don't think this is going to work.
Brooklyn.
Yeah, it's not going to work because of the temperament of the two guys. When Houston traded for Russ, I didn't think it was going to work. Not because of their temperaments, just their games don't actually mesh. Russ needs to have the ball in his hand to be effective, and James Harden's one of the three best on-ball players in the league. So why the hell are you taking the ball out of his hand, right? It doesn't make any sense. I think Kyrie and KD's games theoretically could work just fine, but who's actually leading that team?
Yeah.
Who's actually the serious person on that team, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, that's the one thing you could say about Steph Curry and like why it was a perfect situation for KD.
You gotta tip your cap to Steph Curry
because he can handle the franchise leader. Stuff. Yeah.
Yes. Right, and the fact that he could be deferential to KD to come onto his team and be so egoless about it.
It's the same thing that happened with D Wade when he let LeBron in there.
Exactly.
Right. If D Wade didn't have the ego, and said, "No, it's my team. I'm not going to defer to this dude." It never would have worked. But he had to say,
I ain't wasting this time with
LeBron. I'm winning chips with him. So this guy's got to work.
Yeah.
Think about the two personalities we just described, D Wade and Steph Curry.
Yeah.
Woo! Yeah. Lord have mercy, man.
You know, D Wade, that's obviously a very good comp with him letting LeBron come in. But I still, to me, what Steph Curry did is one of the most amazing things ever seen a professional athlete do. They won 73!
Yeah.
73!
Yeah.
Without him!
Yeah.
And it's funny,
I remember...
All right, come on in and join the part. You know?
I remember talking to Draymond about that, and he said that, like, if Steph had said, I don't want him here, KD wasn't coming to Golden State.
Right.
I mean, it would have been as simple as that. They'd be like, nah, I can't play with him. And the minute he said it, then they would have been like, okay, we'll go ahead and try to win it with you guys. And that's how it would have been. But Steph was like, nah, man, I want to win. And he's going to help us win, so let's get him.
And that's my favorite thing about Steph Curry. I've had my issues with the Steph thing in the past, but just the egoless nature of how he handled the KD thing and always said the right things, never, you know, put some subliminal messages in the media and all this.
He's passive aggressive like some other people we know.
No. He didn't ask people to fit out and fit in. He didn't do any of that on Instagram or none of that.
Right.
He was a freaking good soldier.
He wasn't posting any memes.
No, none of it. He just did his job to the best of his ability. He didn't demand Steve Kerr run more pick and rolls for him and all of this. He just went out and did that. And I just find that to be so admirable. And the two homies in Brooklyn who are running the shows have never in their lives demonstrated to be those type of people. And so we'll see.
It's going to be interesting. I'm not sure who they can add in there as from a leadership standpoint. The talent, though, I mean, those are two of the best players in the game. It's just, but we know you need a lot more than that if you're going to be there at the end, you know.
Yeah. And then Dinwiddie and LeVert are two nice players. They're going to they're going to be told to go to hell.
you better go catch,
offensive rebound if you want to touch this.
Once they trade Karis, it's like, dang, man, like, I was hoping he could work out for the Nets because I like his game a lot, man. He was too. They got swept by the Raptors, but he was really impressive in a lot of those games.
Fearless.
Absolutely. All right. Well, look, Mike, man, appreciate you as always stopping by, man. The great insights as ever.
Thank you, Mike, for coming on. And of course, I got to shout you for – I want the listeners to know that Mike – like me, is a member of the Rihanna Navy. So y'all make sure y'all a fellow Navy heads, y'all big up Mike because he's part of the Navy.
Absolutely. The minute I saw that Rude Boy video, I was on board.
I mean, it was building,
but then I was like, okay, I'm on board.
That was it. That was the Rude Boy video was Rihanna, LeBron in 07, 29 points.
Coming out
29
party.
Out of the last 30 points.
That's
Yeah.
That was that's 20, that 25. Was. Yeah, that was 25 in a row.
25
right
straight.
25
yeah.
Uh-huh. In a row.
So they didn't double Rihanna either?
No. They just cleared out. And let her cook.
Y'all ain't going to double this dude that's cooking you.
Really?
Okay. Okay, Flip, you know. All right, gents. All right, fellas. Thank you as always. It was a great one. And hey, everybody, leave that 5-star review. Remember, if you want to subscribe to The Athletic and you haven't done so already, you can do it for $1 a month. Can't get a better deal anywhere for any price. See you.